Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
So as a bisexual woman, I had zero education on any other genitals apart from how to put a condom on a penis, which is just 50% of the time redundant to me. And why is it, do you don't think we have that inclusivity when it comes to sex education yet?
I think it's definitely something that at the moment, a lot of relationships and sex education, it's not catering for everyone in that classroom a lot of the time, and people can feel really left out of the conversation.
Welcome back to another episode of Girls Know Nothing. As a woman safety advocate, I've been a massive champion for comprehensive and intersectional sex education that includes an LGBTQ plus education, as well as safety and well-being. This year, millions of people across the UK will experience a lack of consensual behaviour. In fact, new research from Superdrug reveals that more than a third of people aged 18 to 21 have gone along with sex even if they didn't want to. 41% of people aged 18 to 21 are too afraid to say no when it comes to unprotected sex. And two-thirds of people between the ages of 18 and 21 have received an explicit content over text, WhatsApp, or social media without their consent. It's important to remember that you always have the right to say no. It's important to remember that you always have the right to say no when it comes to any form of sex or sexual activity, and you can withdraw your consent at any time. My next guest is Amber Newman-Clark, Education and Wellbeing Coordinator at Brooke. Amber believes that all young people have the right to high quality and inclusive relationship and sex education. Amber and her team work directly with young people, teachers, parents, and carers, offering a range of education and training programs, all designed to keep young people safe and healthy. Brooke is a national charity that fights for everyone's right to safe, confidential, and accessible healthcare, no matter who they are. Brooke challenges stigma, amplifies voices, and provides lifelong support so that meets the diverse needs of our communities. Brooke is also a partner of Superdrug's You Before Yes Consent campaign. Superdrug's You Before Yes Consent campaign delves in deeper into the crucial but often overlooked world of consent, and it opens up the important conversations about what consent actually means. It's all about helping you feel like you're in the know and empowering you to find your voice when it comes to consent. So welcome to the studio. I've been really excited to kind of have this episode for a long time. Like, I've been trying to get it in the diary because I've done a lot of work with like a lot of different organizations, and I go to schools a lot and I talk to young women and young boys about all kinds of things to do with like sexual health and relationships. And one thing that always surprised me, actually, I think it was when I went to Oxford Brookes open day and someone said to me, what actually is consent? And it freaked me out a little bit because they were in their early 20s. And I feel like if you get to your early 20s and not know what consent or enthusiastic consent actually is, it makes me fear for like everybody else that's going to come after. So what, like, obviously what is consent, and then what, how is that different to enthusiastic consent?
It's a really great question, and it's quite, I think different people have like different understandings or levels of understanding of what consent is, because it depends on kind of when we were taught and how we were taught it. But I'd say that a lot of people that I work with tend to understand what the definition of consent is, which is just permission to do something. But then enthusiastic consent is more the way that we teach about consent in schools and how we hope people would talk a bit about consent a bit more, because it kind of moves away from this idea that like no means no. I think that that was how I was taught consent. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be taught about consent at school, that might be the kind of general way that you were taught about it. But enthusiastic consent is talking a bit more about the fact that we're looking out for an enthusiastic yes. So the person that you're having sex with wants to be there, and they're enjoying what's happening, you're enjoying what's happening, and it feels like it's maybe more got a basis of communication to it, basically, and you're kind of reading someone's body language, their facial expressions. It's got a bit more to it, perhaps.
Yeah, because I think my my education on consent stopped at the tea video.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is pretty much a sign that you went to any form of British educational institution if you'd watched the tea video. Yeah. But I know that there are people that I've come across that when they were having sex, they didn't say yes in the beginning, but then they were eventually convinced to say yes. So technically they consented if you say no means no, but they weren't enthusiastic about it. And I think that's it's really important to be able to teach people to differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
And also like it makes for a better sexual experience for everyone. When you speak to young people in schools and you teach them that about enthusiastic consent as opposed to just consent, you know, how would a person go about practicing that as practicing that in their sexual lives?
Yeah, I think it's something that when we're teaching about it in schools as well, when we put on, if we put on that tea video or they've experienced that kind of method of teaching about consent, it kind of blends in with the rest of the messages that maybe they've received throughout some of their sex education. But sometimes when we come in and we talk about consent and during sex, and we ask young people maybe about how they would know if someone was enjoying something, we might take the sexual example out of it even and help someone to understand it from the perspective of if you ask someone to go to the cinema with you, how would you know if they want to go or not? We kind of take the sex out of it to sort of help people to understand it a little bit better, in the sense that consent is a skill that we're practicing all the time. It's something that we're saying yes and no to things, and then we're also reading people's body language, and we're also reading people's facial expressions, and we're not pressuring people to do something if they're not that keen to do it, because why would you want to, like you said, why would you want to go to the cinema with someone if they didn't really want to go with you, or they didn't really want to see that film? Or I think it's something that it's sort of part of our everyday experiences, but when it comes to sex, it's a bit more complicated because it's got the added taboo of sex. We don't necessarily talk about it that much in society. So the way we talk about it in schools, first of all, is we'll kind of maybe remove the sex from it to help people to kind of recognize the concept of consent again. And then we might talk about how someone who's consenting might feel, what kinds of noises might they make, does their body language look like, and really try and get young people to think about that. And also think about the fact that just because someone consents at the beginning doesn't necessarily mean that they are consenting throughout, and that people can withdraw consent at any time as well. So how might you know that someone's continuing to enjoy what's happening, or how do you show that you're continuing to enjoy what's happening? So it's sort of getting young people to think about that in the context of non-sexual examples, and then bringing it into the context of sexual examples, really asking them what they think about it as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think where there has been a lack of education on consent, people are taking it either not knowing how to get it or taking it literally. I think I saw one comment that kind of threw me a little bit, and it's like, do we have to get to the point where we now get people to sign stuff to say that they've consented to any form of activity? And I think, like, I'm sure you probably get those kinds of questions all the time. So what kind of things do you say to somebody when you're faced with that question?
Yeah, it's a really common one. And I think it comes from a good place of like trying to understand, right? Like we want this to be a really black and white decision, right? And unfortunately, we live in a society where people are quite... there's kind of a normalization of pushing boundaries, basically. Yeah. And I don't think we're that used to establishing boundaries and then being respected. So I think that that is maybe a bit of a backdrop as to why people do want this like kind of black and white answer of like, in this situation, is it consent? Is it not consent? And I do get quite a lot of that in schools. We get that a lot, where young people are like, well, in this scenario, person A does this and person B does this. And, you know, what is, what's going to happen here? What's the legal ramifications of this? So the way that we might tackle that in a school, or when I'm talking to a young person, is really trying to sort of understand from their perspective, what skills they might need to identify it in that person. So like that example that I gave about maybe how someone, what someone's body language and facial expressions might look like when they want to do something, right? They don't necessarily have to say it out loud, but you can generally tell if they're like leaning forward, they are like giving you positive body language and facial expressions, they're smiling, that kind of a thing. And then we do often also get people being like, but what if you're still not sure? Like, what if you still don't know? And at that point, you just ask someone the question, like, do you like this? Does this feel good? And I think that's when we want to really try and demystify communicating during sex, because it is something that's normal and it is something that's okay. And it's actually kind of essential as well that you are communicating with the person that you're having sex with and you understand.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Stand if they're enjoying something or not enjoying something. So that tends to be where we go with it.
Yeah, I think there's like this weird misconception that talking during any form of sexual activity is like a big no, but actually like the older I've gotten, the more I realize it's actually a big yes. Because if you feel comfortable being able to use actual words with a person, you're probably going to get the best experience for both parties or however many people are involved.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that has always been stuck in my brain since it happened is that somebody said to me that every single time a person participates in sexual activity, it's non-consensual. And I don't really understand where they would have got that from, but what do you think shapes people's or young people's perceptions of what consent is?
I think that there's quite a lot of things going on, and I think it's for everyone. It's not just for young people, it's adults as well. And the way that adults talk about consent also impacts the way that young people think about it too. So we've got a bit of a kind of ongoing cycle going on, I think. But I think pornography can have a big part to play in how we understand consent, particularly if pornography is used as sex education. And in this instance, I'm talking about maybe like mainstream free pornography that particularly is maybe more people access. There doesn't tend to be a great deal of enthusiastic consent going on, a great deal of communicating during sex. And I think that part plays an impact. Outside of pornography, there's also other kind of media going on. So film and TV, we tend to have a bit of a script, a bit of a trope in particularly rom-coms where maybe a guy and a girl in a couple, the guy is like trying to win the girl back in, after they've broken up, for example, they're trying to kind of win them back. And that already kind of negates this concept of consent when someone's established a boundary and then that's kind of being pushed or being kind of negotiated. So I think that there's kind of a few parts to play in terms of what influences young people and people's perceptions of consent.
Do you think that's what contributes to people thinking that it's a grey area as opposed to black and white?
Yeah. I think there's the grey area part is definitely a part of it, is this idea that we're not really sure or it's really complicated. I think that there's definitely the fact that we've not really seen it. Like we've not got that much evidence in TV and film. There are definitely TV programs and films that are doing it really well and are doing that work to show consent in really like normalized everyday contexts. But equally, I think historically, it's not always been something that we've been amazing at showing.
So this is something that I'm still pretty much learning as well, but a couple of episodes ago, I had a guest called Millie Gooch, who's part of Sober Girl Society, and we briefly spoke about consent when it comes to being intoxicated. Mm. Obviously, we know that British culture has like a weird relationship with alcohol. And then, you know, boundaries may be shifted or changed, or consent is given differently, if at all, when you're under the influence of alcohol. So, you know, how does a person navigate a situation like that?
Yeah, that is a very common question. And we get that a lot in schools as well. Like that situation I was saying about before, the scenario where people ask kind of, well, this person's had this many tequila shots and this person's had this much to drink. And it's this sort of conversation again. But I think that it's really important to discuss, because so often adults will have the message that we don't drink and we don't have sex in the same time. Like that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And obviously we know that it does happen and it's incredibly common. So that's not really doesn't really give people enough tools to navigate that situation, right? So again, I think we'd go back to establishing the law. So the law is that you can't be incapacitated, basically, and understanding what capacity means in the context of sex. And asking young people, like, how would you know if someone was too drunk to do something? And so you kind of get answers like, well, maybe they're slurring their speech, or they're wobbling around, they're behaving differently. And then if we're again, it's sort of going back to that thing of, if we're still not sure, if that person is still displaying some things but not other things, again, it's always best to sort of go on the side of caution, basically, because there are lots of things that we miss when we are incapacitated, when we're too drunk. Like we're probably a lot less likely to have conversations about contraception and safer sex, condoms and conversations about our sexual health. And then also it's so much harder to read body language. It's so much harder to read facial expressions and to really understand how someone is feeling during sex. So I think that it's something that we don't say, like, you know, it's absolutely off the table, because again, it's just trying to build those skills among people to be able to recognize when someone is too drunk to consent, basically. And if you're not sure, then it's always best to err on the side of caution.
So what would your biggest bits of advice be to anybody that's trying to either get consent or give consent?
I'd say something that I think is not always as commonly talked about is the fact that we might have different ways that we like to communicate, like when we're having sex. So I think that if you're in a relationship, or if you're having sex with the same person, then it might be that you start to get to know and have those conversations about how you like to be checked in on when you're having sex, for example. I think definitely remembering the fact that people can withdraw consent at any time, really good thing to have in the back of your mind. I understand sometimes people can find that a little bit difficult, because it can feel like a rejection sometimes. But ultimately that's something that we all kind of experience at times, and it's definitely still important to respect people and come to terms with that rejection in some form or another. I think that that's something that when it comes to people giving consent, it's, I think, probably quite a like natural thing a lot of the time. And I think that if you're kind of wanting to be really clear about it, you can always like say out loud what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you like, what you don't like. It's kind of communicating that part of things as well, I'd say.
I think it's really important to say as well that being in a relationship, somebody long term or monogamous does not automatically grant consent at every moment. Yeah. It's still something like, regardless of your relationship with the other person, you have to still get it every single time you engage in any form of sexual activity.
Absolutely.
I think that I'm very open about how bad I think the lack of sex education is in the UK. Yeah. And I think that obviously plays a massive part into people considering consent to be a grey area. Why is it important that we even have these conversations, like the conversation we're having now?
Yeah, I think it's because they're happening more. Like they're definitely happening more than they were. But I still think that there are there's a lot of nervousness still. And I think that having conversations about things that make us nervous is a way to help bring clarity and work through what it is that is making someone feel unsure about something. There's still a lot of work that we need to do. There's still large numbers of violence against women and girls in schools and sexual harassment that happens in all over within society, and that's still only becoming a conversation over the last few years, and it still needs to continue to have that conversation because it impacts everyone. It impacts people of all genders, really, in so many ways.
I think my form of sex education, I think the last time I had any conversation, my parents are very conservative, don't talk about any of that stuff. So I had to really rely on what I was getting from school. Mm. And I think my last form of sex education was when I was 14. My class had a male teacher who was a newly graduated teacher, probably about 22, 23, teaching group of 14-year-old girls how to put a condom on a blue penis. And that was pretty much all of it. But then that doesn't give me, it doesn't make me feel comfortable. It doesn't make the teacher feel comfortable to answer questions from a group of curious women. But yeah. Also, like, as a group of, as an all-girls school, is putting condoms on penises the only thing we need to consider?
Yeah, I think that's for so long, that was like as far as it went, right?
And yeah.
That teacher also probably was feeling embarrassed and aware of the thing that was going on in the classroom, and that is something that is part of relationships and sex education, but for so many people that was it, like that was the whole thing, no more to say. And actually we know that there is a lot more to relationships and sex education. The relationship side of sex education is also huge, and talking about kind of what is healthy in a relationship, what's unhealthy, discussions about porn and thinking critically about what we see in the media relating to sex, and then as well our sexual health and kind of the different variety of ways that we can contract sexually transmitted infections, how we prevent them. So there's a lot to it, basically.
Do you think that the rise in young people using pornography to get any form of sex education contributes to the things you were talking about earlier, like sexual harassment? Because pornography is not real sex. Like yeah. I would say it's quite violent towards women.
Yeah.
And depending on what you look at, but for the majority, I would say it's quite violent towards women.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely, in mainstream pornography, there's definitely a narrative or like a script, and it tends to always follow a pretty similar set of things. It is quite prescriptive a lot of the time about what sex is, what counts as sex, which again isn't particularly inclusive of people of different genders and sexual orientations. And so we've got a kind of a type of sex that's being portrayed in pornography that, if we didn't have sex education at all, then that would be a huge problem, because it would be teaching a lot of myths. It would be perpetuating a lot of stigmas in society, whether that be racially marginalized groups being represented in pornography, and as well women generally, as they're represented in a particular way and usually a really sort of discriminatory way. So if that is the only way we learn about sex, then that is going to have an impact on the way that we think about sex and what that should look like in private, when actually they're really different things a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that contributes as to why people don't talk about sexual health as much as they should?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's that, and there's also a history of sex being stigmatized and it being a taboo topic, particularly in the UK, I think.
Yeah, I think this is going to sound really weird, but the sexual health clinic, like, we used to be an after school trip. This is going to make it sound so bizarre. Groups of us would just go to the sexual health clinic after school. But at the same time, like, you knew that your other friends were doing it and you're all there for the same reason. But at the same time, if you saw any other group of people there, you'd be hugely embarrassed. And I guess that's when the stigma is that you said about, you know, if the girl came out of the clinician's room to go to the bathroom to take a test, you'd heavily judge that person, when actually, you know,
yeah,
there's no harm in doing it.
And this kind of idea that STIs or sexually transmitted infections are kind of dirty, or that they are any different to any other type of infection that we get. And again, it's like, we go to the clinic or we go to the doctors and we ask a professional and we get help for it. And that, we don't usually get as as embarrassed about like a lot of other infections, but when it's to do with sex, we do feel more embarrassed, or we do feel like there's a lot more stigma attached to it. So I think that there's, yeah, a common denominator there, which is a lot of the time that we're not that comfortable talking about sexual health.
I think it's just because as well, there's always that stigma that if you catch something, you must have slept with everybody under the sun, but you can literally catch anything even the first time you have sex.
Yeah, absolutely.
But do you think that, what do you think is one of the biggest barriers as to why particularly young people don't get tested as often as they should?
I think that education can be a part to play in that, and not necessarily knowing. And then as well as that, I think there is part to play in the stigma and the worry as well that maybe parents or carers or teachers might find out when actually sexual health tests are completely confidential and parents, carers, teachers wouldn't find out if someone went to a sexual health clinic or if they ordered a test online. They're usually packaged really anonymously. In a way that is meant for privacy, kind of a thing. So it's only up to you who you tell about your health, basically, because it is private and it is confidential.
Yeah, I mean, I will give a massive shout out to, I think it's my local NHS Trust, that their sexual health stuff's really good. You literally get a test kit through your door. And it's like you said, you literally would never know. I actually didn't know what it was when I got it.
Yeah.
So that's how like unnoticeable it was, and even when I handed it back. But you know, there's lots of different things. We always talk about STIs when it comes to sexual health, but sexual health isn't just about STIs, also about your well-being. I mean, when we say sexual well-being, what does that actually mean?
So sexual well-being, or well-being in general, is talking about kind of lots of different parts. So it's kind of how we respond to our environment, as well as kind of what's going on inside us as well. And sexual health and well-being has had like an interesting dynamic, I think, over the years, because we've started to recognize how key sexual health can be within our wider well-being and how linked mental health and sexual health can be as well. Because if we are, there are kind of lots of different situations where our issues in our sexual health will impact our mental health and vice versa. And often sexual health is, for a lot of people, ignored or not something they want to speak about or worry about. So that I'd say is a big kind of piece in that. And I think if people kind of wanted to learn more about their sexual health and well-being, or about consent, they can go to the Brooke website, or You Before Yes as well, the You Before Yes website. So if people wanted to learn more, they could go to the Brooke website or the You Before Yes website as well.
When I was a teenager and I was first sexually active, I was always thinking about, does my body look right? Does it smell right? Is it ugly? And because with the lack of education around what anyone's genitals may or may not look like, you look at images online, but they're not representative of like the average person. But then also I've seen lots of things about the design of vagina surgery being one of the most like commonly looked for. And I don't even know where like this kind of idea comes from, that it has to look a certain way.
Yeah, I think that body image and particularly how our genitals look in general is really informed by wider society, media, pornography. And as we said before, the kind of very mainstream looks, basically. And it's very prescriptive, and it can make people feel really anxious about how, if their body looks any different. Again, kind of down to the fact that everyone's bodies and they're like, everyone's faces look different. So of course, all of our genitals are going to look different. Of course, that's going to be the case. We've kind of got such a variety of different like humans on this planet. And I think that our bodies and our faces and our genitals, all of these things are going to look different, basically.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Code Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Really unhelpful, I think, when we only see one type all the time.
I did put a Q&A box on my Instagram because I know that I get a lot of DMs from teenagers that this is how I know that sex education hasn't moved on from when I had it 14 years ago. From teenagers asking me questions or, you know, like saying that they are unsure about certain things. And obviously I'm not the expert. So I kind of told them to treat this as if it was a sex education lesson that they never had or that they could ask questions that they were afraid to ask in front of everyone else. But I think, you know, a lot of the themes are very similar. And I think one of the biggest questions I got was, how does somebody know that they're ready to engage in sexual activity for the first time?
Yeah, it's a really common question. And one we get a lot in schools as well. And one we get young people kind of asking us to come back as well sometimes to talk about it more. And I'd say a big thing is it's a lot of kind of internal questioning, I would say. So thinking about trying to put to the back of your mind as much as you can, what other people are doing, basically. So like there is no set age that someone should be having sex or not having sex. There are plenty of people that aren't particularly interested in having sex now or ever as well. And that's completely valid. We've got people who are sometimes informing, like, if they want to have sex or not based on maybe what their friends are doing or what they see other people doing as well in wider society. So again, I'd kind of try and work out if there are kind of like healthy reasons for wanting to have sex and not so healthy reasons. So like maybe a healthy reason for having sex might be because you really like the person that you're having sex with or because you are curious about it. You should generally be feeling kind of excited. Obviously, everyone feels a bit nervous the first time they're going to have sex. That is really normal. But there's a kind of difference between like an excited nervous and a scared nervous or a worried nervous. So I'd kind of have a thought about that for yourself. Sometimes we ask young people as well, like, what do we think that someone who is ready for sex, like, what do we think they are thinking about, like, in terms of contraception and STI testing? Are they kind of already thinking about some of those things? Do you know a bit about consent already and understand how you might check in with your partner to check that they're having a good time and that you're having a good time? So those are all signs that you might be ready, but also only you can really decipher that, I think.
So the first time I had sex, it was with the right person at the right place. Like, I didn't feel pressured into it from that person. But I think that because we'd been together for a considerable amount of time before we had sex, and everyone else in my year was like, haven't you done it yet? Why haven't you done it? And it kind of got, so I think I don't regret the person I lost it with, but I would have, if I had not had those external pressures, probably would have waited a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And also I think it's really important to say that to people, it's not going to be amazing your first time. It's not going to be like fireworks. Oh, it might be for some people. For me, it was not like fireworks and stuff. It was really awkward, very clumsy, but I felt comfortable with the person that I was with. So then, you know, you kind of just laugh about it now. But
yeah,
I think people expect it to be like you see in pornography.
Yeah. And sometimes a question I get a lot as well is like, is it going to hurt? Particularly for people with vulvas, that's a question that a lot of people ask, is like, is sex meant to hurt or is it going to be painful the first time? And so often kind of trying to explain that it can sometimes, but it doesn't have to for everyone. And there are usually things that people can do that means that it's not as painful, or if it is painful at any point, we should stop and make sure that everyone's okay, basically. But it's definitely something that is like with anything, the more you practice something, the better you get at it, basically. And the more confident you feel being able to tell someone what you like and what you don't like, you're more comfortable with the feelings that come up as well. So Yeah.
Another one of the really common questions I get is about the lack of representative sex education. So as a bisexual woman, I had zero education on any other genitals apart from how to put a condom on a penis, which is just 50% of the time redundant to me.
Yeah.
And why is it that you don't think we have that inclusivity when it comes to sex education yet?
I think it's definitely something that at the moment, a lot of relationships and sex education, it's not catering for everyone in that classroom a lot of the time. And people can feel really left out of the conversation. And I think that a part of that might be that professionals, teachers, parents, like don't know, like they don't know how to have those conversations, or they don't have the information at hand. And I'd say definitely do your research. I'd say using like websites like Gallup, they have fantastic relationships and sex education, and as do Mermaids and Stonewall and lots of different organizations that support parents and carers and LGBT young people and adults. But I think that one way is that we at Brooke talk about sex in a more accessible, inclusive way is we're not talking solely about one type of sex. So when we're explaining and we're asking young people what they think sex is, we're not just talking about a penis goes into a vagina. That's the end of the sex conversation. That's actually not on a lot of people's, that's not what a lot of people engage with. So you're kind of already ignoring like a portion of people, whether that mean be that someone is heterosexual or LGBT, it's not something that everyone is going to engage with every single time. So we do need to talk about sex in a more inclusive way with a more variety of definitions. So we talk about kind of sexual terms basically that people use. So that might be anal sex, oral sex, genital to genital touching, mutual masturbation, using toys. And there's slightly different conversations that come with that when it comes to STIs or consent. So that's sort of when we're just entering the conversation about sex, we're not assuming the kind of sex that people are having. It could be any of those things, and people need to know how to be safe when they're engaging in any of those types of sex.
I think another question as well is that when we talk about sex and do you know what's even in any form of media or sex education, is that we never talk about female pleasure or the pleasure of people with vulvas. Mm. And I feel like people feel shame when they talk about it. Oh, it's not as important, because if you're procreating, technically the woman or the vulva owner doesn't need to have a good time in order to procreate. Mm. So how does a person approach that conversation with their partner?
In terms of about like what feels nice or what feels pleasurable.
Yeah, or like why we don't talk about it in general.
I think that it's something that kind of is probably approached differently depending on your relationship. And particularly in school situations, or when we're talking about sex in general, or we're talking about condom use, for example, pleasure can kind of be integrated into these conversations. And it's so important for conversations about consent as well, because if someone is consenting, if someone is engaging in enthusiastic consent, and they're clearly showing that they're having a good time, that is showing that they're enjoying it, and which is pleasure, right? So pleasure and consent, the conversations come really hand in hand. And so when we're talking about any sort of realms of sexual health, we can talk about the fact that sex, for a lot of people, the reason that they're having sex is for pleasure. Most of the time, the majority of the sexual encounters that people are having, it's not for a baby. Like, that's maybe a few times, or however many times it takes for someone to have a baby. But there's also pleasure is in the mix there. It's a really key reason why people are having sex in the first place. And that's regardless of gender. Unfortunately, when it comes to female pleasure or pleasure for people with vulvas, it's still somewhat of a mystery almost. Like, people kind of treat it like it's still a really mysterious body part.
which, the clit is a myth, but it's not.
which is, I think, down to like lack of relationships and sex education, to be honest, not really having an understanding of anatomy, which is such a kind of, that's like beginner level, isn't it? That should be where we start the conversation. The start of the conversation can also be around consent, and we have those conversations with children and young people before we talk about sex at all. We're talking about consent in the context of sharing toys or asking someone if they want a hug or a high five. Like it's choosing and giving people choice elements to the kinds of touch that they're experiencing. So it's kind of, we can stage it up. We can use it in a way that, we introduce topics when people are ready to hear them, when they're age appropriate, when they're stage appropriate, for people to experience. And so it's relevant to their life as well. Cause again, it's not that useful for us to have these conversations when it's going to just go over someone's head and they're not ready to hear it as well. So,
yeah, I think you pretty much answered what my next question was going to be, was like, how do parents know at what stage they should start introducing certain topics of conversation to each age group or like gender of baby or child? But you've pretty much explained it about how you introduce like consent and sex and relationships to each other.
Yeah, I think consent is definitely the starting point, as well as understanding our bodies, giving the medically accurate terminology, vulva, penis, genitals. These aren't, they're not bad words, they're just body part words, like our knees and our elbows and our fingers, like whatever, that's just all body parts. So that's really important for keeping people safe, mainly. Yeah. It's important that we know accurate names for our body parts so that we can tell someone if something's wrong. I'd say when young people start asking questions, we should try and answer them in a way that's honest as much as we can without going into so much detail that it's going to go over their heads.
Yeah.
And I'd say consent is something that you can practice in the home. Non-sexual examples, you know, when you're explaining body parts, when you're sharing something, sharing food with someone, you're offering them slice of pizza and they say yes, like that's an example of someone wanting to do something, giving you permission to do something. So there's lots of ways we can explain it that isn't to do with sex at all. And then when someone does get to the age when they are interested in having sex or asking questions, then they've kind of got the framework. Then it's not a really confusing subject and it's not a really big gray area either, because they've already practiced it in a way.
So why is it so important that we talk to young people and teach young people about consent?
So there's so much research about why it's important to teach about consent. Superdrug did some research with 18 to 21 year olds about this as well. So they revealed that 92% of 18 to 21 year olds say that sexual education didn't improve their confidence around sex, sexual consent and relationships. So it's definitely inadequate. And 3/4 believe improved education around consent in schools would help elicit positive change. So that kind of comes from young people directly, that that the education that they're getting isn't really enough, and that the education that they could receive would actually make a big change and an impact.
So if young people were so desperate for sex education to become more well-rounded and more open and honest, why is it that we're not getting that?
Yeah, so we're quite behind in this country generally. We only established mandatory relationships and sex education in schools in 2020. And the rollout of that has come, you know, over the pandemic, but also a kind of lack of training or proper funding for teachers to learn a lot of this. If you think about the teachers that we have as well, a lot of them went to school at the time that we went to school and we weren't really receiving adequate sex education. So if you've only ever experienced certain type of sex education and then you're expected to teach it, like you're not really going to be able to have the tools that are available to you. There's definitely some teachers out there doing fantastic work, but the overarching theme is that they really, really need some support, some training, some extra funding to access this and really do benefit to the young people. So I'd say that, yeah, that's a part of it.
I mean, I personally wouldn't feel comfortable giving somebody that kind of education, because that's not just something that they're going to learn to pass an exam. That's something that's going to impact their entire lives. But so I think that's a lot of pressure to put on one person. But why is it that there is such a big backlash when it comes to sex and relationship education?
I think that we've seen an increase definitely since the mandatory relationships and sex education guidance came in, and a little bit previous as well. There's definitely been a kind of politicization of relationships and sex education, quite a lot of myths as well about what's actually being taught. And that really brings out a lot of anxiety in parents and teachers and adults in general, that young people aren't being taught age appropriate or stage appropriate stuff. And we've seen a huge backlash against LGBT inclusive relationships and sex education, which we at Brooke are particularly worried about, and how that will impact relationships and sex education moving forward.
Thank you so much for like having that open and honest discussion with me. I know that there are a lot of young people, do you know what, not even just in the UK, but anywhere in the world that listen to this podcast that don't feel like they're being heard when it comes to sex education. And I know plucking you out of a classroom somewhere and putting you in front of a camera is out of your comfort zone, but I really appreciate everything that you've spoken to about today and everything you do. So
thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries. For more information, education and support on how to improve your understanding of consent, for more inclusive LGBT plus information about sex and relationships, on having sex for the first time and how to ask for consent, you can visit superdrug.com/you-before-yes.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at coda.com.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.